Hello, it's Monday, August 10th. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, 6 months on, the reality of life under Zimbabwe's power-sharing government.
You fight the struggle incrementally. You get one inch, you beg that, and you live to fight another day. And slowly, this place is changing.
UK Music's chief executive, Fergal Sharkey, tells us record companies need to keep up with the times, or young people will keep downloading for free.
Out of those that were downloading music, something like 80% of them said that they would be willing to pay for something like an all-you-can-eat download service.
Claims and counterclaims surrounding the death or not of the Pakistani Taliban leader. We try and get to the truth.
They do not have access to the village where he was killed because it is surrounded by Taliban fighters.
Plus a post-mortem of England's disastrous day at Headingley. Before that, we start as always with a news update and paper review.
12 people are confirmed dead and more than 50 others are missing in Taiwan after Typhoon Morakot caused the island's worst flooding in half a century. Nearly 1 million people had to be evacuated from the coastal regions of China over the weekend as strong winds and 9-foot waves hit the country's eastern coast. The typhoon's now weakened to a tropical storm. People should ignore best before dates, cut food waste and prepare for price increases. Those are the messages from the government's latest food strategy, which considers how the UK will secure its food supplies over the next 20 years. Experts are warning that with rising temperatures and population increases, the era of cheap food is over and domestic food production will have to be taken more seriously. The Liberal Democrats are calling for new restrictions on the surveillance powers of Britain's public bodies. New figures show that a request is made every minute by police, councils and intelligence service officials to spy on someone's phone records or email accounts. Last year, there were almost 1,400 new cases opened every day under the controversial Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, or REPA. And the pace of deterioration in the UK labour market is starting to slow. 10% more employers plan to cut staff in the 3 months from June than recruit. That's according to findings by the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. It's significantly better than the previous 3 months, but the report still concludes that unemployment will rise to over 3 million in 2010. To the papers now, where the Telegraph leads with more muck on our MPs. The paper claims politicians plan to use taxpayers' money to help fund their own childcare arrangements. The Independent has the first unauthorised dispatch from an officer on the front line in Afghanistan, while the Sun and the Mirror report that Michael Jackson has finally been buried, but that's unlikely to be the last we'll hear from the Red Tops on the King of Pop. Finally, there's a rather shocking picture of Lord Mandelson in the Mail, the business secretary's topless on holiday in Corfu. Turn to page 6 for more, the paper says. Perhaps not. You can keep up to date with all these stories and more throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
First, to Zimbabwe for a frontline report contrasting life in Harare in August 2009 to life 6 months ago, when Robert Mugabe and his arch-rival Morgan Tsvangirai teamed up promising unity in government. Some argue the democratic momentum has led to signs of economic recovery. Others say the change is superficial. We hear now a spectrum of opinion, including a high-ranking government official, a teacher who was threatened with abduction, and also from the director of a gay rights group. The Guardian's Africa correspondent David Smith reports.
Zimbabwe's unity government is 6 months old. One of the most prominent members of this team of rivals is Tendai Biti, the finance minister and secretary general of the Movement for Democratic Change. I caught up with him at Harare's Jameson Hotel.
We're in a fork. Going left could be going towards a new Zimbabwe. Going right could be doing a cul-de-sac and going back to square zero. And one day you wake up and say, we're working to a new Zimbabwe. The other day you wake up feeling that we're going forward. So this inconsistency is not good enough. We need to resolve the outstanding issues on the GPA. We need to show irreversible commitment to the global political agreement and so forth. It's also fair to say that Zimbabwe last year is not the same as Zimbabwe now. Zimbabwe now, you and I would not even be having this conversation. They would arrest you outside that door, and that's fact. But you can do that. You can write your story. That's progress. What we have done on the economy, the use of multiple currency,
2 years ago, you couldn't do that. One of my predecessor ministers was fired for suggesting the word devaluation to the Zimbabwean dollar. But now we've even abandoned the Zimbabwean dollar. So I think the lesson is very simple. In difficult situations, in fragile states, in authoritarian states, when you have committed yourself to fight for change using peaceful and non-violent means, as some of us have committed ourselves to, you fight the struggle incrementally. You get 1 inch, you beg that, and you live to fight another day. And slowly, this place is changing. Slowly, this place is changing.
There might be food in the shops and schools and hospitals reopening, but for some people, the terror of President Robert Mugabe's regime continues.
My name is Kennedy Muri. I work as a teacher in Zimbabwe, in Kwekwe District. There was a time, beginning of June, when the local leadership of ZANU-PF came for a rally in our area where my school is located. During the process of their rally, there happened to be a lady who stood up and said that at my school there was a teacher by the name Kennedy who was teaching kids and denouncing the president, Comrade Robert Mugabe, saying he lost the elections, so he's there by default, he's the president of Zimbabwe by default, something which never happened. It was cooked. So the matter was taken to ZANU-PF National Center here in Harare. I talked to my boss, my headmaster. Then we decided that it was a sensitive story. But it was around mid-June, around the 23rd, when my headmaster went to town for his pay. He was called by the provincial leadership of ZANU-PF. And they told him that they were supposed to go and abduct a teacher by me, my name, that day. And the people who were going to abduct me were already there. So this man was my savior. He refused to take these people, saying that he did not know the door to my house where I stayed. I'm not so sure if the headmaster was not there, if he was going to refuse. So that's how I was saved. The headmaster left the offices and hired a car. He had to rush to my place and tell me to leave the school immediately.
But while fears persist over the return of violence at the next election, there are some minorities who hope that a new Zimbabwe can mean change for the better.
My name is Keith Goddard. I'm the director of GALS, which is the Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe. I would generally say that in this country, it's never been the worst place in the world to be gay or lesbian. I mean, it's not like parts of northern Nigeria where you're threatened with stoning and there isn't the death penalty and that kind of thing. But there was a climate of hysterical homophobia which was whipped up by the ZANU-PF and more particularly the president. And but over the... And so, you know, when we first sprang out the closet, so to speak, there was this kind of shock that homosexuals actually existed in this country. But over the years, you know, I mean, the situation is by no means perfect because we don't have no access to television or radio or the state-controlled press who simply, if they do mention gay or lesbian people or LGBT people, then it's only in the most disparaging terms. So there's very little education that we can do. But we've embedded ourselves fairly well into the kind of local NGO network. And people, especially people in urban areas and amongst the younger population, have become more used to the fact that gay and lesbian people exist.
It would take a brave man to bet on the future of Zimbabwe. Some people will tell you that the economy is recovering and the march towards democracy is unstoppable. Others insist that this is all window dressing and nothing has changed. They argue that Morgan Tsvangirai has disappointed his supporters by trying too hard to please Robert Mugabe, who said recently that the unity government was going well, which must mean that it's going well for him. After 6 months of power sharing, Zimbabwe stands at the crossroads between dictatorship and democracy. It could go either way.
The Guardian's Africa correspondent David Smith, and there's more analysis on this story at guardian.co.uk/world. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, Decca Aitkenhead interviews this week's stand-in Prime Minister, Lord Mandelson, Read what he has to say at guardian.co.uk/politics. Far from fashion folly, Kath Kidson secures a 60% rise in profits. Details at guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle. A new survey shows we're a nation of lazy people. Read the story, if you can be bothered, at guardian.co.uk/culture. And Chelsea versus Man United. What the Community Shield result can tell us about the season ahead. That's at guardian.co.uk/sport. A report out today highlights the size of the problem facing the music industry of illegal downloads. It shows the current generation of under 25s is fanatical about music. The general attitude reflected by Aaron Copland, who once said to stop the flow of music would be to stop time itself. Incredible and inconceivable. But with 86% of under 25s admitting to illegally sharing or downloading music, how do you stop this free flow of music? Today's report says the average computer hard drive has the equivalent of 17 days of music on it, a significant chunk of which hasn't been paid for. Fergal Sharkey is the chief executive of UK Music, the umbrella body representing the British music business. He's been speaking about the report's findings with Guardian reporter Sam Jones.
Well, it's the second year now that the industry's done this, and it is very simply a very big, methodical piece of research trying to look at the behavioural patterns, the interests, the association and the relationship of young people, predominantly 14 to 24, and their relationship with music. And it's just really us as an industry trying to better understand what they're thinking about, how they're consuming music, how much they're enjoying it, and trying to find ways that we can change and adapt our business and our industry to better suit what young people are demanding of the industry in the modern world that we live in.
And what did you find? What were the key findings of the report?
On one level, are young people just obsessed with music? Yes. And probably way more so than any previous generation. Music is just such an extraordinary fundamental part of their everyday lives. And I think on one level, that should give everybody involved in the music industry, whatever level, huge cause for optimism. Because quite clearly, that is something that's not going to wane very quickly. What is something we're becoming more comfortable with and trying to find solutions and answers to is that, yes, while music is phenomenally important to them, the way they're now consuming music and the number and variations of platforms, the ways they want to access music, is just growing week upon week upon week. Much as some people would have us believe things like MP3 players, mobile phones, actually it's the computer that's now become the centre of the music universe. And what the research is showing up, by way of example, is that young people now on average have over 8,000 songs on a library, sitting on a computer or a hard drive, which they then put about 1,700, 1,800 onto the MP3 player, and that's the bit that's in their pocket, and that's the bit that they'll go off about town and go meet their friends. Having said that, suddenly things like MSN and Skype have popped up out of nowhere, and quite clearly the inference is that while they're sitting there chatting online to their mates, they're also quietly in the background swapping music files with each other, using the file transfer facility in things like MSN and Skype, Bluetooth, and getting together with all your mates and pretty much having kind of Bluetooth exchange parties seems to be quite clearly a fairly ingrained part of their life right now. And it just goes on and on and on and on. And even then, that quite clearly, when you get to things like YouTube and MySpace and being able to access streaming music on that level, again, is phenomenally important to them.
But presumably the kind of thing that worries you most is illegal sharing, piracy, call it what you will. How much evidence of that did you find going on amongst the young people that were surveyed?
To kind of rephrase that, is it something that worries us? Yes, it's something we have to deal with, but it's equally just as important to understand the way that young people want to consume music legitimately, so that we can make sure that we are giving young people whatever bit of music they want, whatever platform they want it, in whatever way they want it, because that's just as big a demand in the industry. Yes, quite clearly, about 63% of them were telling us that, yes, they do use things like BitTorrent and file sharing and are downloading music on a daily, if not a weekly basis. Now, quite clearly, that's quite a substantial proportion of young people. But balanced against the other side of it is that desire to engage with the industry. Now, by way of example, out of that 63% that said they were downloading illegally, and by the way, they understand it. They know completely what they're doing, possibly is not right. They understand copyright. They just quite frankly don't care. What they're quite clearly trying to explain to us at the minute is we can get it for free. and we're not going to get caught. Now, does that mean that we have to try and find ways to work with these young people, that we can actually develop a more supportive, cooperative working relationship with each other? Because personally, I think it does. And that's one of the reasons why we're trying to research this kind of behaviour pattern and understand better what ways that young people want to engage with music. Having said that, by way of example, out of those that were downloading music, something like 80% of them said that they would be willing to pay for something like an all-you-can-eat download service. Well, as we know, a couple of weeks back, Virgin Media announced a deal with Universal to provide exactly that kind of service here in the UK. So for me, yes, it is an issue we have to address and something we have to deal with. But equally, I think we have to be very clever about how we go addressing it.
The Guardian's Sam Jones speaking with Fergal Sharkey on the future of the business of music. Still to come, the living autopsy of the England cricket team.
The great problem for them now is that they go to the Oval having to win the match to regain the Ashes. Australia only needs a draw now.
Before that, we switch continents again, this time to Asia, where it remains unclear what happened to the Pakistani Taliban leader, Baitullah Massoud. Last Wednesday, you may remember, US intelligence claimed Massoud had been killed in an American drone attack. The following day, there was a meeting to choose a successor between two frontrunners, Hakimullah Massoud and Wari Ur-Rehman. That meeting, it's alleged, resulted in the death of one of them. The Guardian's foreign correspondent Declan Walsh is in the Pakistan capital, Islamabad, to try and clear up the confusion for us.
It appears that a sort of long-standing rivalry between the two men erupted into a shootout. The government says that at least one of those two people have been killed, but it's still the subject of many claims and counterclaims. Wali Ur-Rehman has spoken to the Reuters news agency this afternoon, so he does not appear to be dead. And the fate of the Hakimullah Massoud still has a question mark hanging over it.
And with regard to the Pakistani Taliban leader, Baitullah Massoud, there is no body there, is there? And yet US intelligence says there is no doubt about his fate.
That's right. The problem is that it's extremely difficult for either the Pakistani or American authorities to definitively confirm Massoud's death, just because the manner of his death was through a drone strike from the air, and they do not have access to the village where he was killed because it is surrounded by Taliban fighters and has indeed been out of government control for several years now. So they're saying that if they had a DNA test, they would be able to approve this. But lacking that, his death still remains the subject of speculation. There still are some Taliban commanders who say that he is alive. And then there are other Taliban commanders, even from within his own group, who say that he's dead.
Well, with all these claims and counterclaims and also reports of widespread unrest, how badly damaged is the Pakistani Taliban?
I think it's a very serious blow for the Pakistani Taliban. Baitullah Massoud's genius, if you like, was that he managed to unite a very disparate group of militant commanders across the tribal belt. Now, as we see from these reports of infighting, that unity seems to be fracturing very quickly and very violently. So for Pakistan, this is probably good news, at least in the short term, because it's disrupting the ability of the Taliban to carry out these attacks. On the other hand, many of the other commanders who were directly responsible, particularly for the suicide bomb attacks in the country, still remain at large. They still have their organisations intact, and if they choose to do so, they could relaunch their campaign of violence in the major cities of the country as well as in the tribal belt.
And what about the relationship between the Pakistani authorities and the US? Is that a productive, a symbiotic relationship?
Well, this drone strike is seen as being something very positive in an otherwise troubled relationship between the two countries. Previous to this, Pakistani public opinion, and indeed publicly the government, had been very hostile on the issue of the drones. Every time a strike went off, both the military spokesman and the civilian ministers would issue very strident denunciations. It's very interesting, in the last number of days, the tone about the drone strikes has changed dramatically, because now the drone has hit somebody who's considered or was considered as Pakistan's public enemy number one. So that's the impact on public opinion behind the scenes, this is also probably a sign that there is greater intelligence cooperation between Pakistan and America in the tribal areas.
The Guardian's Declan Walsh in Islamabad.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Finally, we appeal to the sports masochists among you with a reflection of the fourth Ashes test at Headingley. A triumphant performance from the Australian side, who duly dispatched England to level the series so far. Australia need only a draw next week to allow them to keep hold of the Ashes trophy and crow mercilessly about their success. Paul Haywood is the Observer's chief sports writer. I asked him how much of England's defeat was of its own making.
Well, I think almost all of it. The Australians came up with a very cunning and effective bowling plan, I think. And a number of their players really had excellent games. And there was Marcus North particularly, and Michael Clarke was majestic with the bat. But ultimately, I think England failed to learn the lessons that were apparent from very early in the game. And this morning's sort of late order flourish won't detract, I think, from the general paucity of the performance.
Is that easy to say in hindsight, or have you been saying that for a while?
I think England came to this test match in pretty good nick, certainly statistically, because they were, they led the series 1-0. The great problem for them now is that they go to the Oval having to win the match to regain the Ashes. Australia only needs a draw now, so it's been a spectacular turnaround, really, I think, in the dynamic of the series. More importantly, perhaps, the sort of psychological damage inflicted by Australia over the last two and a bit days is going to take some getting over. And England are obliged to alter their lineup, I think, now. Certainly, Bapara won't play at the Oval, and Ian Bell's place is in jeopardy as well. And they have to hope that Andrew Flintoff comes back, both for his ability to break up partnerships and this sort of talismanic presence as well.
Do you think there could be any surprises? As you say, England are going to have to make changes.
Yes, I mean, we're going to have a lot of fun in the next few days speculating about Mark Ramprakash and, dragging Michael Vaughan out of retirement. And those games will be played. There isn't a depth of resource for the England selectors to draw on. They might Bell might survive for that reason alone, but the problem is going to be finding somebody to replace Bapara.
I've left the tough question till last, Paul, and that is, are there any positives that England can take away from this match?
It's difficult to be positive when the top scorer in both innings for England was the spinner, Graham Swann, with 62. I think the problem here is that this Headingley test has revealed a certain sort of psychological frailty about England. You would have thought that a really tough streetwise team would have realised early in the match that they were playing the wrong way essentially, and they needed to adjust to the conditions in the way that the Australians did. They do have a history, I think, of getting themselves out of trouble. This is an England team that perhaps performs better in adversity than it does when its nose is in front, and that might be the main hope for England supporters, I think, going to the Oval. They're quite good when they're backed into a corner, England, better than when they're actually in control of a series, as they were before they lost at Headingley.
Well, that does sound quite optimistic. Can we have a prediction from you then for next week?
Yes, I think I think Australia will retain the Ashes by winning at the Oval, because I think too many of their players are playing too well for them to surrender the initiative that they've just seized up in Leeds. And I think even if England play to their best now and Flintoff is running around on both legs instead of one, I still think now there's enough form and enough quality in this Australian side to get them over the line, particularly, I'd say, as Mitchell Johnson looks back to his best. The Australian selectors stuck with him, and now they're reaping the dividend from that.
Paul Haywood, the Observer's chief sports writer. And that's it for today's Guardian Daily. You can download tomorrow's for free and legally from 7:30. Producing today were Phil Maynard and Ben Green. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.